My name's Del, I'm an addict. And I feel incredibly vulnerable. And I'm wondering why I'm here. And somebody's telling me to speak up, and I hate microphones. I hate my voice. Let's start there. I really hate my voice. I always have done. As a child, I hated it. As a child, I sounded like a girl. As a child, I got on a bus and they'd say, "Hello, love." Which is really confusing. Really, really fucking confusing. And then I grew my hair long. And then it got even more confusing. Like any true good any addict, I sort of, somebody, they asked me to do this on Monday. I shat myself. I thought about it on and off. I'm feeling like I'm going red. I'm feeling like, what have I got to give? I'm feeling like this is the sort of stuff I used to run from. You know, this is the stuff at school I hated. This is the stuff at school that kept me back from learning. All this self-obsession, I have to speak up, was in my head. I permanently lived in my head as a child because it was safer there. Being gay in, which was the late, well, I was born in 1960, which makes me 48, which makes me 8 years over the time that I thought I was going to, I thought I was going to live till about 40 and then I'd die. So I'm 8 years up on that. I first attended NA in 85. There's one person here in this room that was there. And I'd like to say that I'd stayed clean ever since, but that's not the case. Once I came to NA, everything really changed. You know, I went back to drugs several times, but it was never the same. I came from Ireland as a kid. We were immigrants. We lived in one room in Kilburn. The first feeling that I could probably put my hand on was shame. I felt very ashamed of where I came from. We were taught to work hard, steal, and not tell anybody what we were doing. Emotions and feelings were something that I never came across until 1985, when I walked up the steps of a treatment centre and actually felt fear, and actually didn't realise until I got to the room and the counsellor laid into me that I was feeling frightened. And fear has run through my life all the time. I'd rather feel fear than anger, because I'm frightened of my anger, but I'm really angry as well. My mother's an addict. Who doesn't have a program, who believes that her will has got her through her life. She relies on God, a religious God. But she doesn't have the freedom that we have when we admit and accept that we're addicts. I love her to bits, but sometimes she's really hard work. And can only spend a certain amount of time with her without feeling really nutty. It's sort of like you go round and it's like she takes the top of your head off and puts the liquidizer in and turns it on and then closes it up. And then she repeats herself. And please God, I hope I won't grow up to be like her. This is all a bit disjointed. The last chair I did lasted 5 minutes. And I hate doing chairs. I hate exposing myself. Although when I expose myself, I feel love and I feel accepted, but I prevent that from happening by letting my fear get the best of me. Sitting here today proves to me that it actually works, because I don't like sitting up. I don't like talking about myself, although I do, but I don't like talking about myself in public. I feel like I'm still going quite red. I work throughout my addiction. And stole a lot of money and used a lot of drugs. I went into the music business at, I was 16. And it was just before punk took off. And there was a huge amount of drugs available. And I was treated like a mascot and went on tour. and it was supposed to be really glamorous, and parts of it was, but parts of it wasn't. The loneliness of not being like everybody, and you know, I went to look for help. I was on something, they, years ago they had this thing that they wired you up to a black box. They thought it would help. I have no idea what this is about. But I went to this clinic and they wired me up to a black box and they were supposed to calm me down. And, you know, this was what they thought help was about. And I went to the doctors and I remember asking him for a liver biopsy because I thought that's what I needed because I drank so much. My addiction moved from what we used to call dope to coke, to drink, and eventually to smack. And I oscillate between smack and drink. I use one to get off the other, and that was my pattern. And it got really, really messy. Because on drink, I was a nutter. But on smack, I was quite all right. And the first treatment centre I went to, I was really shocked that they really wanted me to give up everything. Because I really wanted to give up drink, but I really didn't want to give up heroin. So I held on to this longing, or I held on to this affair I had with smack for a long time, and there were yets. You know, I wasn't going to stay clean if somebody close to me died. It was one of them. And I did about 9 years clean and sober, and I had a sponsor, but I'd never done any steps with any of my sponsors for some really strange reason. It's actually taken me 22 years to complete one set of steps. I'm quite proud of that. Because you just do it when you do it. You know? It took 22 fucking years. You know, and what will keep me clean might not keep anybody else clean, but this has kept me clean. You know, my story is totally, part of me coming today is to actually put it into some semblance of order because of, you know, I because there's so much shit that goes on and because I've got a loyalty card to, for a treatment centre, I feel like it's just too long. So part of coming today is actually to put some sense to it and put it together and maybe put it to bed and let go of it all. The first 9 years in recovery were unbelievable. It was like a new life. I came out, I was gay, I was happy. I got a boyfriend after about 3 years. Didn't realise he was a cunt, but hey, it took me 16 years to work out the bloke was a cunt. You know, I had my palm read 2 weeks ago, and this woman says there's no more heart, I can't see any heartache. And I went, oh, I've forgiven him. I've forgiven him as much as I don't want to ever see him again in my life. And I don't wish him ill. Yeah. I used to wish him dead and in pain, but I don't wish him dead anymore. I wish him happiness. I believe if I give out the vibe that I want to come back to me, it's sort of, you know, halfway to sort of a better life for me. I was in NA and I went to lots and lots of meetings. We did about 40 meetings a week. All the meetings were usually in Chelsea. I never really felt part of NA in the beginning. It was very... There was only two other gay people. It was quite affluent. You know, I didn't have a trust fund. I wasn't part of any banking family. You know, and I didn't speak with a funny accent. So I never really felt at home, but I continued to go, and I felt at home a bit, but I just had all these reservations. The first sponsor I ever had was given to me by my counsellor. The second sponsor I found myself. The first sponsor thought, which we had great fun, we just used to go nightclubbing. It was great, it was great, it was fabulous. We went to some of the powerless clubs in London at the time. It was unbelievable straight. I highly recommend it. But the second sponsor was murdered. And this was the excuse I needed to go out and use again. My dad took me round to his flat after we called the police to say that we couldn't get hold of him because he was always around. The police thought I was the boyfriend and we'd had an argument. And some other people in NA said if the police didn't break the door down, that they would do it themselves. And I remember going to the flat, it was New Year's Day, and there was I looked through the letterbox and there was a broom across the door. Anyway, the police went in the next day and he was found dead. And then I had to spend days talking to the police, telling them what was going on. And all this time I just felt really, really numb and in shock. And anybody that came anywhere near me in either fellowship, I just thought they did it. I was so paranoid. It sort of brought me to this place. It brought me to my knees. And I didn't, because it was actually within the rooms, I didn't actually use... I'm not blaming that I needed the excuse to go out and use, but it, where I went, where I felt safe, was not safe anymore. And so I started smoking hash, and it was quite manageable for a long time, and I didn't attend meetings. I stopped going to meetings. And the minute I picked up boots, all hell let loose. I ended up, after about a week of drinking, I quite liked going around hotels, it was quite good fun. I'd move from hotel to hotel, so nobody could find me, really paranoid, and eventually ended up in Bournemouth, where my boyfriend picked me up, and they checked me straight into another treatment clinic. On a Friday night, where they do mustard seed, and I've never seen anything quite like it in my life. They were downstairs banging their fucking tambourines, and I thought, if this is what's getting cleared, is I ain't having it. I don't want to know. I thought they were all nutters, and I did another 4 weeks there, and felt an awful lot better, and thought I sorted myself out. And then came back to the rooms and did another 5 years and stayed clean and sober. And went out again. I started to take Sominex, which you buy in the chemist, which was really innocent. And the progression just led me straight back into vast amounts of coke, vast amounts of smack, loads of prescribed pills, and eventually to drink again. Whenever I drank, I quite like drinking really publicly, which is really embarrassing. So it gets really dramatic and really messy quite quick. I hate that bit when I go into blackout and I can't remember what the fuck went on. And then I find underwear that I don't know where they come from. That's really hard work for me. You know. All through this time, I worked, believe it or not, and was really successful at what I did, and ended up doing exactly what I wanted to do. All the promises, even though I used, all the promises came true. You know, I was financially secure. I had goals, I wrote them down, I got what I wanted. It's just that there were these little glitches that used to take me back right back to the beginning. And I believe today that the reason that that happened is, one, I didn't accept I was an addict, and two, I couldn't be fucked to do a step. I was really frightened of writing down step four. I was really, really frightened. I'd built it up into such a bogeyman, and I'd built me up into this monster that did all this stuff and wouldn't commit it to paper and certainly wouldn't tell anybody else about it. And I thought, what's the point of going to treatment? You go to treatment, you sit in a group, and you tell everybody all the worst things, which is what I did. But there was some magic that happens when you write it all down in the form that your sponsor tells you to do it, and then you read it to him, there's something happens, and I don't know what the fuck it is. And you know, when I did five, I held back, and there's one thing I didn't tell him, which was I was really, really ashamed of. And it took me, I don't know, a few months to tell him, and I told him, and he just sat there, he didn't even bat an eyelid. But to me, that was enormous. You know, it was so big, I cannot tell you what I did with these things that I got up to. You know, and I didn't, by not sharing them, they just became so out of hand. They just ate me up inside. The shame and the guilt of some of the stuff I've done just ate me from inside. And it's as if I held on to it and allowed my addiction to hold on to it, to fuel it, to actually get me back out there. My dishonesty kept me out there. My unwillingness kept me out there. My closed-mindedness kept me out there. And it ain't pretty out there. It really is not. It's really dangerous these days. The next time I used was when I found my wonder. I was getting jealous over a computer. This is where my program was at. I was jealous over my boyfriend's computer, and it was eating me up. It was eating me up badly. And at night, it set up on this computer, and I'm not very good with computers, but I've learned to be quite good with them. But anyway, he'd sit up at night, and he'd be on this computer. Anyway, the long and the short of it is, I was able to search back and see what he was up to. And there's this site called Gaydar, which is for the gay people. And all the straights, whatever, it really doesn't matter, there's more straights on it than there are gays. But, and there's this picture of him with a hard on, standing in our hallway without his head on, you know, with his head cropped off. And it just was like a fucking volcano. It was like, I thought, you cunt. You fucking cunt. Didn't matter that I was sort of doing the same thing anyway, but was paying for it, which is totally different. These are all these things, I sort of rationalised shit away by doing it in different forms, and I wasn't really looking for a boyfriend, but no, what was all this over here? But anyway, I was outraged, as any good wife would be, and I do like making people laugh. It sort of disarms them, and I feel that they like me more. And it also it sort of ridicules myself in such a way. Anyway, I'm still working on that. I do actually like being gay. I really like it. I really like it. It's difficult at times. Growing up in the 60s and the 70s, it was really difficult in London. You know, being called a fag or a batty boy for most of my time at school was really hard work. You know, and not wanting to go to school and being bullied at school was really hard work. I am quite angry at the fact that it sort of stole my youth, and it sort of stole what I could have used my brain for by keeping me in the lockdown in this sort of state of fear most of the time. So, Gaydar picture boyfriend. So I confronted him with it. And I'd been with him 16 years at this point, and thought something was a bit wrong. Heavily, really, really codependent, really badly codependent. Really took me a long time to see through the mist that he was up to something. And we went, it was a really difficult year. I worked for a man for 15 years, and he was coming up to retirement at the same point that I'd sort of put on the end of my boyfriend's and me living together. I did a year of couples counselling, completely stoned out of my box, which was really difficult, and trying to sort this all out. So petrified that I was losing the two most important men in my life, my boss and my boyfriend, completely spun out by this, with huge amounts of fear again. Where do I go? You know, I go to the thing that I think that's going to sort me out. I always return to the place that I think will help me. And it never does. It really never does. It always fucks me up even more. I knew that we were going to split up. He sort of paid me off. I got a lot of money to leave the flat, basically. The flat was jointly owned. It was worth a lot of money. And he knew I was fucked up. And I got some money, and I moved down the road from the house because I couldn't move that far because I was so frightened of being on my own. I was so scared of being on my own that I paid escorts to be with me most of the time for about 6 months. It was so painful. Every noise, the lady was talking about hallucinating. I didn't know whether I was hallucinating in the daytime or in the evening. It didn't really matter. There was people coming out of walls. I moved to a church in the city, and there were only two other people living in the whole borough, you know, and I lived in a place that was incredibly beautiful, but it drove me fucking insane. The noise, every creak, every movement, I would think there was somebody in the house. I used to lie on the floor with my feet on the door in case somebody would come in, with my head on a pillow, seeing ghosts, you know, and that was brought about by a mixture of a lot of crack, a lot of coke, a lot of smack, a lot of K, and it was just, that's what I lived on, and tequila and Ren Boys. That was about it. Some of it was sort of fun. It was really bizarre, was what it was. I used to like dressing up and going out, so I never, you know, I used to go out clubbing, but there'd always be, in the end I had a minder looking after me because I couldn't go out. I used to like dressing up in priest outfits, which really got a bit bizarre in the end, and it just got really loose, and I got really loose, and I lost a shitload of weight. I used to think when I was using, I used to look quite good, because I wasn't. I always put on a bit of weight when I come into the room, so I struggle with my weight. But you know, that's part of my addiction. I struggle with all sorts of parts of my addiction, but the main one I struggle with, and the one that I have to keep under. I accept the fact that I'm an addict and I can't use. You know, the food I deal with later or tomorrow or something like that. I went from that period of my life, I went into a job that I always wanted. I wanted a job in this particular agency and I got it. You know, I walked into this job, which was really hard to get, and I just walked all the way in. And then a month later, walked all the way out because I just fucked it off. I really, sometimes I look back at my life and I think, what the fuck were you doing? You know, all these really good things, and I just exit because I wasn't worthy. I really wasn't worthy at that point in my life. Look how nervous I am. I've just scratched my leg. Sorry. I entered treatment for the third time, and going to treatment a few times is really not good fun. It's really, you know the script, you know the lecture, it's really boring. You know, the only thing I went there was to stop using drugs, you know, and get fat, and have snide comments fired at me from the counsellors, and then write really shitty things in the diary. I hope you have to eat this food. You know, in fact, I've got to go back a bit. The first, second treatment centre, I got there, and they said, did I know anybody? I went, no, I don't know anybody. Half of the staff I'd first come into the rooms with, which made it really difficult to sit in group when you knew that, you know what, she got up to, and that one got up to. And so it just made it a bit difficult. But, always at the back of my mind it was using, always. It was always there. My addiction is like this train that can gain momentum, and if I let it start, it can just keep going and going until it smashes into this big wall in chaos. The last time I went into treatment, after about 6 months of being away from my boyfriend, I got back in, and I only stayed about 4 weeks. And I got out on New Year's Day, I think it was, or New Year's Eve, which was quite a good day to come out of treatment. And what they said was going to happen did happen, and I used again. And it took me a while to get in back. What worked for me this time was to actually come to the meetings and to put my arse on a chair and do what I was told. It really is possible to... The only way I could recover is to come to these rooms and to actually put my arse on a seat and do what I was told. I've got a commitment. I started to share. I got a sponsor and I started to do the steps. And ever since then, everything sort of got an awful lot better. My life isn't, you know, it isn't perfect by any means, he says. I was actually talking to somebody about it. Throughout my life, I've always wanted certain things. I'm quite materialistic, and I've always managed to obtain them. And I wanted to live in the country with two dogs, and that's where I live at the moment. At this point in time, it sort of suits me. He says, stuttering, but it's still not enough. I want more. I want more. You know, I'm 48. I quite like saying that, I'm 48. Because, you know, this is an age I never thought I was going to get to. You know, and 50, I'm quite looking forward to it, because it's going to be, you know, 50. Fabulously 50. You know, say, oh, it's quite good fun. But I sort of think I'm coming to a sort of midlife crisis. I was quite sick a few weeks ago with my stomach, and I've been quite weepy. And I had my fortune told, which I've never done before. And I've been reading these really strange books about, you know, you can get it if you want it, sort of thing. All these sort of self-help book groups. But I truly believe, I was born an addict. I believe I was born pure. I believe I was born the way God wanted me to be born. I was brought up a Catholic, and Catholicism is a religion. It's not about God. God is totally different. I believe I was born spiritual, and that I moved through all the things that happened to me and circumstances and my addiction took me away from that point. And now, through working the steps, I'm hauling ass back to the point that where God wants me. I have a huge belief in God, and have spent many years digging around trying to sort out what is my bit and what isn't. And being gay and being born a Catholic isn't really, you know, there's not much more, you know, you're really on top there, you know, fucking go for it. Dig hole, mate, go on. And then when the scoutmaster tried to get hold of me when I was younger, that was quite confusing. You know, and the priests are all dodgy. So, you know, it was hard work. Working out my religion was really hard work. But when I sort of separated it up, and was allowed to believe in anything I wanted, I could believe that, you know, even if I didn't have a God, I really did have a God. Because not believing that I had a God meant I had a God, because I believed that I didn't have a God. Simple. It took me a long time to work this out. You know, I didn't really get behind the thing that they said I could have a red bus. That sort of didn't work. But, you know, my God is a he, obviously. And it sort of changes, you know, it moves around a bit. It is evolution, it is stars, it is the moon at one point, it is the sand, it is, you know, it's everything. It's the way plants grow, it's the way we live, it's air, it's the whole lot, all brought in. And sometimes it's more and sometimes it isn't. I may go on a holiday and think, oh, let's bring that in. I also believe that the people that have died that I love are part of my God. I believe that my God lives within me. I believe my God talks to me through my conscience, and my conscience knows what is right and what is wrong. Not to say that I don't believe that we're going to go somewhere really, you know, if we're bad, we're not going to go somewhere. I don't know what happens. I've been under long, you know, I've been out of my brain a long time. Sorry, in the past I've been out of my brain. So like coming out of a blackout, it's sort of like coming out of an operation, and you wake up and you don't know where the fuck you've been. So what is death anymore? You know, what can it be? It might, you know, a friend of mine died a long time ago, and he thought he saw a blue light. You know, well, maybe he did see a blue light. Maybe he did. Some of the happiest times in my life have been saying goodbye to people just before they died. The freedom that allowed me to actually say I love you, and to listen to it and to hold their hand, was, I cannot tell you what joy that has brought me. I've as I said, I can say again, I've completed all 12 steps. Doesn't mean I've recovered. I can't get hold of that one. But, you know, I can't also get hold of the people that do repeated steps either. I don't understand that either. But, hey, it'll take me another 22 years to do another step. But when I did some of my amends, the worst one was my mother. And I didn't really... I thought it was going to be really easy to sit there and just say, I'm really sorry. It wasn't at all. It was really hard. And it took me several attempts and several visits. And eventually I got her on her own and I said, look, I'm really sorry. And about the past. And she said, you have to say sorry again. So I had to say sorry twice. And, you know, I caused her a lot of pain. So in some ways it's quite like my mother to make a joke out of it. But in another way, she really meant it. One sorry was just not right and it wasn't enough for what I'd put her through. Whether she's an addict or not, that is immaterial. She is my mother. Her addiction is something else. It's an animal that I can't tame, I can't do anything about. I have to leave her with it. She has taken her path and she doesn't use, and that's all I can help for. She's a dry drunk that's off her fucking head. But, you know, so be it. My spiritual awakening has come from doing the 12 steps. The combination of doing them all in the order that is suggested, not the ones I want in the order I want, but 1 to 12 in an order with my sponsor, who took a long time to find, who isn't on a pedestal by any stretch of the imagination. Thank God. He pisses me off, I have to tell him. He didn't turn up yet. You know, he said he was going to turn up, he didn't. Something happened and he didn't ring me and I said, it's not on. You've got to ring me and tell me. It's really important for me to do that stuff. You know, I just let people walk on me. It's really important to say, that pissed me off. You know, what does it take? Ring me up. And I could, you know, I could say, oh, it was to do with his family, it was to do with that. No. You let me down. You know, I try it. Part of the biggest joy in my spiritual awakening is actually helping another addict and sponsoring somebody, which I never thought would actually happen, because who would want what I had? And the joy this has brought is unbelievable. Sometimes I think he's sponsoring me. I do. He thought it was a good idea I did this. Having daily contact with another addict really helps. Having just somebody there that may rely on you or may not rely on you. Being codependent, I quite like sort of people sort of relying on me and that sort of thing. And I've came up with my style of sponsoring is a bit like I cluck. You know, I'm a bit like a mum. I want to make sure that he's got his vest on and it's cold. I want to know he's been to work. Yeah, you know, I want to know if he's had a ruck. You know, I want to know all these other things. And if he brings forward stuff that I can help him with, then that's fine. I'm in no position to badger anybody about completing any steps at all. Really not. Thank God. It's come to time. I've actually really enjoyed this, if I'm honest. It's been really nice to piece it together and to speak longer than 5 minutes. I truly believe any addict, if they want to do something, can do it. I think you have to keep it within the frame of... I don't think I personally want or could be a brain surgeon, but I believe if you have enough faith in something, you can ask that something for help and it will put you in the right frame of mind to actually attain that. I don't believe that there isn't a God. I have faith in something that I don't know anything about. And that's what faith is. Faith is sort of, it isn't tangible. I have faith that I have in something that I know nothing about, which gives me enormous peace. And I try to deal with life on life's terms these days. Sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes I get the ump quite a lot. you know, I've got a boyfriend that, at the moment who's driving me slightly nuts because he ain't doing what I want at the right time, in the right order. But I have to, you know, I'm getting older and I have to accept that maybe this is my last shot at it, so maybe I should keep my mouth shut. He's a bit younger than me, which sort of flatters my ego. But, and I always think the grass is greener on the other side, and I don't always think I will. But I'm going to shut up. I'm going to thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much.